We're back, and sorry about that. That's my fault. absolute pleasure to get a chance to bring back Dr. Stephen Allday, Horse Health Today, brought to you by Luberson and Reborn. As I just said to Steve off there, I said, you know, it sort of got out of the habit and practice, but at the same time, there hasn't been, it doesn't seem to me, I mean, it hasn't been like a ton of problematic issues that usually have me reaching for Dr. Allday, but it's a pleasure to get you back, Steve. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Good to be back.
Well, let's first of all catch up on everything. Talk about the business, Luberson Reborn, and everything that goes on, family and you know, the team roping and everything that you're involved in.
Yeah, well, you know, business is good. You got no complaints. We've had a lot of, you know, uptake, you know, since the changes in rule to 2 weeks and sometimes, you know, further out the injection stuff. So our business has been good that way. Family is fantastic. I mean, you know, I've been so blessed. And like I said, I've got a great family and everybody's doing good. And especially my wife, you know, here's to her. She's the glue that keeps everything together. And my two kids, Kenny and Kelly. Kenny works, he's a musician, and he got a little setback during COVID, but my daughter in the office. So there's that. And then team roping, I made a little bit of money this year. Got a big second down in Fort Worth at the U.S. Finals. And you know, split for me and the guys here from Kentucky. Two Kentucky boys went down to Texas. And we pulled $16,000 out of there. So
there you go.
That was fun.
I love it. Well, and you know, yeah. you actually, and we've got a, I've got a laundry list of things to bring up with you, but you did say something that actually, I'm going to go there first, and you talk about, you know, what's going to be this new administration in terms of HISA, and you know, there's going to be a changing landscape, Steve. We'll talk about LASIX in a minute, but yeah. what is your read on the early portion of what HISA is trying to do? And you know, I suppose, you know, worrying about, I don't know if you want to include things like, you know, the crop restrictions, but you know, from a racetrack practitioner standpoint, what's your early read?
Well, you know, as far as trying to, you know, listen, the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act was essentially created with the purpose in mind of the introduction of performance-enhancing drugs and not approved medications into the racetracks and into the racing, you know, itself. It was culminated, you know, when the FBI essentially put together that sting operation, or at least, you know, I don't know how exactly you would call it, but, you know, they found a number of people in both thoroughbred and harness racing that were using, you know, regularly a bunch of unapproved, non-FDA approved medications with the intent of affecting the outcome of events. Okay.
Yep.
In the long and the short of it, Steve, is that, you know, they're basically taking, you know, medications, in their opinion, in a lot of people's opinion, have taken horsemanship out of the racing game and introduced guys that basically can't lead a horse or couldn't halt or break a baby or basically couldn't do anything, don't really know, you know, the nuances and the history and the background that goes with the horsemanship. You know, they all of a sudden show up on the block and they use, you know, enhanced medications to try to, like, you know, build a resume off of it. So, you know, I mean, it had to, I guess it was at a break point. It had to stop. So they removed, you know, a group that they could bring a case against, and I guess they just had another ruling or some sort of somebody was found guilty yesterday and given a sentence.
That,
it,
harness, the harness, yeah. One of the harness vets.
Yeah, a vet, that's what it was, a vet. But it turned out there's a network of veterinarians, trainers, pharmacy compounders, and sales people. You know, a network of people that are out there pushing this stuff. So, bottom line is, you know, you've got one down, and probably, or at least it seems like maybe more to go. And, you know, the good part is, you know, you've got a responsible, well-trained, well-educated, and knowledgeable group of professional law enforcement people that are old and that have been brought up to date as to what can happen, background in racing, and they're essentially doing a pretty good job, along with, you know, the group of investigators from Five Stone and also the guys from New Jersey that worked under Jeff Garrett. A network of people, and I'm feeling like the harness industry, which is not adapted, or is not, you know, they have not come under the umbrella of Heisman yet, but I think it's the NFL, not the law, before they are too. Basically you're having a spillover between both industries, and bottom line is both of them need to be regulated. They got to be watched, you know, and having a responsible, knowledgeable FBI is a good thing. I mean, it's, you know, these guys, they know what they're doing, you know. I mean, they've been doing it for a long time, and, you know, I know there's a lot of people out there who think they do wrong and this sort of thing. Well, you know, they're protecting us, so that's what, you know, a lot of good with bad. There's a lot more good than bad, that's for sure.
Well, that's what you hope. And, of course, the biggest thing and the portion that, at least for a certain percentage of stakeholders and for horse players and for horsemen, was the potential to offer uniformity. And let's shift into, you know, some of the, you know, the rip from today's headlines and from the last 2 weeks. And you had two back-to-back rulings, the one in Indiana, Tom Amos taking a 7-day benching, and O'Neill 30 days.
And I thought it was 60 for O'Neill.
60, but a stipulation for 30. If he doesn't, he would have to serve another 30 if he is found to violate any other ruling violations over the next year. And Amos said, listen, it's a mistake, and whether it's cross-contamination or whether it's an overage or whatever, I get it. So, you know, Tom just accepted. Yeah. And O'Neill is doing the same thing. But talk about lidocaine again. I mean, I think we did it last year or when the lidocaine positive associated with the Baffert horses came about. Talk about its use, first of all, Steve, and its practical use, and if whether under the current, you know, the current environment, there is no practical use for it, and what would be an alternative to, you know, to basically get it out of harm's way, and so that horsemen don't have to answer to these problems.
Well, it comes down to, you know, unfortunately, as much as I, you know, because I'm not a big fan of the way this thing goes down, but like this, lidocaine is a useful anesthetic, local anesthetic primarily, and that's its function. And it, in the hands of veterinarians, it's utilized for suturing, like topical surgery, things like this, like skin lacerations. We do it when we do Caslix, when we suture fillies. We use it for, you know, diagnostics, blocking, and it's in some ways for like colics, you know, they'll give IV doses of it for a long period of time to stop gastrointestinal ileus or shut down, things like this. So there's lots of ways it's used in the veterinary profession, so it's not going to be something you can live without. At least you'll have an analog there, thereof, but let's say carbocaine, bifenthrin. That's my choice. I use bifenthrin routinely, and there's a few others that are out there, but a lot of lidocaine and bifenthrin are in veterinary, the bulk of what you would use as anesthetics, you know, for either local blocking for suturing and or procedures, or let's say diagnostics. The problem you have with the Zydocaine is that it is also filled over the over-the-counter pharmacy area. You can get it with in patches, like for instance,
right.
What we talked about with Jimmy Barnes had for the back. They have back patches where you get lidocaine, and essentially it perfuses through the skin into the local area and takes pain away. There's creams you can buy. Let's say antibiotic. Let's say you know, like the triple antibiotic, and they'll put lidocaine in it for pain. And it has useful application. The problem is, an over-the-counter medication can also spill over into other aspects of life, and in this case, you know, things that are out of control of a trainer. Let's say, for instance, he has a groom that gets cut and then puts it on a horse, or, you know, gets it on a leg, or gets it near a wound, or makes a mistake and puts it in heels and didn't see the lidocaine part, and then, you know, the trainer pays the price for that. And, you know, that could have been very well what happened. I mean, more likely these horses weren't given a block in a joint or in a topical or a peripheral nerve in order to stop, you know, pain to an area, because it's just, you know, nobody in their right mind would do this knowing that the sensitivity to testing is as high as it is. So, therefore, it's a mistake. And, you know, I think, you know, the cooler heads prevailing, and the jurisdictional bodies need to look at these things and say, look, you know, I'm not saying the guy's going to get off scot-free, but, you know, you can't give a guy a life sentence for, like, you know, like running a speed sign, you know, stop, you know, unless you kill somebody, of course, or you did it purposely, or you're out running the police, you know, whatever, that kind of thing. Sometimes, you know, you've got to, like, cooler heads have to prevail. You have to look at the situation and how it occurred. I think Arkansas did a pretty respectful job of what they did when they handled the back patches with Jimmy Bones, you know, on the horses there. I mean, it was such a minute level, and it wasn't going to affect the performance. It certainly wasn't given intentionally to block anything in particular. It was just one of those cross-contamination situations. And, you know, I think that's really what has to, like, take place here. And let's be hopeful that the highest, you know, board and the people that are advising and or part of the advisory
right.
groups, veterinarian and whatnot, will advise them as to, like, you know, why things need to be, you know, sensible. The good part is, yes, uniformity is important, and, you know, in taking it away from racing jurisdictions which have, you know, a lot of prejudice and you know, likes and dislikes on a personal basis about who runs and who does and this sort of thing. I think, you know, having a removed central body where everybody knows playing field for everybody involved,
right.
I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
That's something that we all should, it should be something that we aspire to achieve, you know, for the industry, so people feel like you're getting a fair shake and everything's working out the way.
Exactly.
And you go from state to state, and you have, you know, uniform rules, medications, and everything. So you know the playing field has been leveled.
Now, Graham Motion has spoken, you know, eloquently about that. That's all that, and many horsemen have said. We just want to know that what we're doing in New York and Pennsylvania and Maryland is going to be just as acceptable in Kentucky, Louisiana, Florida. That you know, let's eliminate that portion of the challenges. One quick aspect of lidocaine is it in terms of its metabolite and its, you know, the way it registers in testing, Steve. Is it something that lingers? Is it something that, you know, that I mean, obviously metabolism in every animal is going to be different, but is it something that can create a problem? And what are the typical parameters in terms of 72 hours, 48 hours, a week? What are those parameters?
Well, it's often, you know, depending on how much air gets infused, And if it gets sub-Q, if it gets stays, you know, a little bit gets deposited in the dermis, sometimes this can stay around a little longer, if it's in a joint, if you're blocking. I use Lidocaine, so I can't, you know, I use Carbocaine. In my opinion, it's a lot more predictable. And, you know, I just go with a rule. I know to go inside that, but anything that's got to be blocked, like, you know, diagnostics and or whatever, I'd basically go at least a week out, and I'd be well within, you know, I'd be more than safe. And the bottom line is, I mean, if you can't block a horse a week out from a race to find out what's wrong with you, you probably shouldn't be running to begin with. It's kind of sense to take over with a lot of this stuff, because typically if you're doing a diagnostic, or let's say you're doing local, meaning like you knock a foot out and you work your way up on a diagnostic workup on a horse and you come to a joint, you know, and that sound, you're obviously probably going to implement normal further diagnostic procedures, meaning radiology, ultrasound. You can go to MRIs, you can go to, you know, CAT scans now, or things, just depending on what your either previous problems or you're following up on something. This horse has had an area that's been worked on before. Let's say you had fragment removal or screws implemented in a cannon bone. I mean, there's a lot of different factors have to be taken into consideration. But the bottom line is, you know, you're going to get that closed and horse blocks. You're probably not going to be running anyway. Yep. That's what it comes down to.
There you go.
You know.
That gets us to topic number two, and we'll dial back to Breeders' Cup for this and the two major injuries, and of course Epicenter pulling up with the condylar fracture, and as it happens, DJ Fisk showed me the scan, and it was a piece, really a significant piece, broke away. And condylars over the years, Steve, you've explained. And actually, before I bring up the pelvic injury to domestic, let's give everybody the whys and wherefores about the displaced, the non-displaced, and the screwings, putting the bone back together, especially if it melds nicely, and why some condylars horses come back and resume their careers, and why some can't.
Well, a condylar fracture means that what's occurred is a fracture has occurred down in, meaning from the cannon bone where it's in the belt lock, and then up the actual shaft of the bone usually they're lateral. In this case, this horse had a lateral condylar of its right fore. And displaced means that the entire fragment from the base at the cannon the cannon bone all the way to where it broke away from the parent portion or the large portion of the bone outside. So therefore, in order to fix it back into position, and they have to go in with the scope, position it where it's back together, and then put at least two screws in, because what that does is you can't just put one, you got to put two. Because that will create what they call rotational stability. It means it won't be able to lever backwards and forwards, so it makes it stable in two planes. There are cracks in the cambo. We get them in the back, which you have to do certain radiology and this sort of thing. Or you can just pick it up on regular radiography, and that's a non-displaced, meaning that the crack just occurred at the joint but did go all the way up and pull the bone away from the parent portion or the large portion of it. A lot of times a low screw and this to compress it back together can remedy this with time off, and it heals up, the horse comes back down. And I've had horses come back and win grade ones after having this done to them. And I think a lot of people the problem with the displaced fracture is that when they pull that away, you basically create a fissure. You can never get them 100% at the joint level the way, like, perfectly. Now, they do come back. I will tell you right now, I've had horses come back, win many, many good races after getting, a displaced condylar fracture replaced. But, knowing that this horse is a grade one winner, and you know, the first crop of a horse that looks, that I would predict at this point, it looks like he's going to be a highly successful, sire. This is a pretty outstanding individual for a first crop. And, you know, could be the next time. You know, I mean, he was second in the Derby, got beat by a freaky bit of a freaky long shot. He didn't get a greatest trip in the Preakness, things happened. But, I mean, it all came together for him in Saratoga and the Jim Dandy and Travers. And then, you know, a grade one winner and the horse's first crop, you know, and being bred well from a good program. He said track record, you know, although be at a deep distance at, you know, at the fairgrounds, so I wouldn't give it too much. But the horse ran phenomenal, and I think he's probably well this year. In my opinion, I think he's going to be champion 3-year-old. And, you know, even though he didn't win he didn't win a classic, any of them, but he placed in two of them. And, you really have the value of the horse and what you could be taking off the table, you know, financially. And that's probably an astute decision to go ahead and send this horse to let him breed. So that would be the financial move. I mean, the horse probably can come back. But, I mean, I don't know about all the arthritis or how much damage got done in the joint and this sort of thing. And you can only do the guy that went in there with the scope and tape. So, but decision I can't argue with. It's probably a good move.
We've heard, maybe you've even said it, that they've given the remodeling and I guess what, the calcification and so forth, that the bone can heal even and come back even more stout, essentially more, or let's say less vulnerable after a surgery like this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I would ever use that terminology. I think it'd come back as good, possibly, but bottom line is, you know, horses are really, really unique from the standpoint that, I mean, unlike cars or airplanes or other things, you know, they're much, much better off if you maintain them than they go with original equipment versus, trying to replace parts. In this case, I've had plenty come back, but it was always in my mind that, you know, that this is something we have to keep an eye on. And I think the trainer, and in the long run, it's probably an astute, you know, decision to you know, not push them and let's take good care of this horse. Let's not, you know, take half the season away and then we end up coming to it anyway. And so there must have been a further extenuating circumstances of being decided, hey, let's, you know, retire this horse. So
what,
yes, they can come back and be fine, Steve, for sure. There's no doubt about that.
What's the typical recovery time and then the typical, you know, training to get back to fitness after contract?
Well, it's all in, you know, a lot of factors. I mean, you know, if there was any fragments, what the rest of the joint looked like health-wise by the surgeon. But let's say a non-displaced condylar back, you know, they'll be back under tack sometimes within 60 to 90 days easily. And, you know, like I said, I had one horse that came back and he was back training within 90 days, and then he ended up winning two grade ones, you know, of course, but he still trained on dirt every day and had degrees too on it, so that says something for that. The displaced ones are a little bit more complicated because you always, you know, no matter what you do, sometimes you have even a micro step in there. It needs to be not quite as equal with the other, and you can create a little bit more damage, meaning that you'll release more particles and things into the joint. You can have more problems managing it, but they could come back. Usually it's a little further, you know. My experience has been most of these displaced condylar fractures, they come back, you're looking at six, maybe it's before to six, maybe as long as 9 months before they're back doing their thing again. And you monitor, you'll make sure, you know, there's no lysis, you get any complications, infection problems, you know, at their, you evaluate it to see if there's any sort of arthritis in the joint that would be indicative of maybe a small micro step in there, anything that's blatantly obvious, or even sometimes the fragments that didn't break away, you know, during the displacement, sometimes they'll show up, you know, later. Most of these guys go through these tours pretty good now. So, you know, but you're still looking at probably 6 months at most of them, imagine.
Very good. I appreciate it. Talk about the pelvic fracture, and for those that have been listening, you know, throughout, we lost a mare early in the year, did a mouse to a pelvic fracture, and it was just heartbreaking. And I guess you and we've talked about them, Steve, because it's dangerous for different reasons. For one, if the horse, you know, if the horse wants to lay down, and they've got a fracture, they can't get back up, so that's a problem. There's internal bleeding issues that crop up with this that can't be reached with surgery. I mean, there's many circulatory problems. I mean, talk about pelvic fractures in the racehorse.
Well, the biggest problem with pelvic fractures is that, you know, early on they start showing you a lip signs. They can be misdiagnosed or misidentified for quite some time until they rear their head and the horse is essentially three-legged. And, you know, they get misdiagnosed with other problems for a while. They can get it confirmed. Most of the time, when I even suspect one, I send them for a nuke scan, and they can pick it up pretty effectively without really a lot of complications. And the bigger problem, Steve, is if it happens during a major, like, athletic event and during race, a lot of times, you know, they can't get down, and you can't let them get down, and we'll put them in a stall if it fails to hay around and try to get them to stand up all the time. And knowing that until this thing starts becoming stable and doesn't have that much movement in it, to where the fracture ends will still sit and wait until they get stable. You essentially need to have, you know, as much as possible. Of course, the advantage you have is that the horse has the ability to lock its cycle and rest, you know, one leg and not the other, and that's a good thing in this particular case. But, it can be extremely difficult and traumatic. You know, the bigger problem you have is during a major event, a lot of times the fracture can be so devastating that it'll, you know, the splintered end can perforate a large vessel, an artery or something, and a lot of these horses will basically bleed to death. I mean, it's, you know, internal hemorrhage, there's really nothing you can do. You can't get to it fast.
Nope.
For the amount of hemorrhage that occurs. So there's a lot of extenuating factors for the diagnostic. And then, you know, choosing a, you know, typically if the pelvis is looked at as a box, and if one side of the box is the fracture unstable, they essentially just will, you know, keep them as stable as possible. If it's fair, you have to be more cognizant of the pelvis because they'll have to deliver foam through it, and it doesn't have the ability to maybe expand or have the amount of capacity it used to. Colts, different story. They don't have to, obviously. So the only thing you have to worry about there is that it's stable, and they can, you know, if it's a stallion that's going to go to stud, it's got to be stable enough for them to be able to put a lot of weight on the pelvis, like during the covering of the mare, if it's a thoroughbred stallion in particular. If it's more than one side, yes, they can put a plate on it, but typically it's so difficult to get that done. Unless it's an extremely valuable horse, that's probably not going to occur, you know. It's more likely to happen in a foal or maybe at the latest, but even then it would probably be a situation where they would probably elect euthanasia instead, you know. But, I mean, nothing's impossible. It does occur, but, you know, I mean, the horse has to have awfully good genetics, like, you know, and even to survive at that point, because there's so many complications that occur when a horse can't ambulate, you know, normally meaning founder of laminitis, things like this.
Well, knock on wood, this feels like the situation with domestic spending is very fortunate, and we haven't heard an update this week, but he was being released from Ruth Riddle, so that, probably limited, you have to limit his movement in the stall, and
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. For an extended period of time until he would be probably reevaluated, you know, on an ongoing basis until the small paddock starts. So
right.
It would be a slow, steady, ongoing process. And then if they're going to go ahead, you know, I don't know what the intentions are, if they're planning on either, you know, obviously going to stud or whatever. But, I mean, he would be on the radar for normal reevaluation and evaluation on a regular basis, probably for the better part of the next 9 to 12 months or so.
Finally, Steve, I'm just curious, you know, over the course of the year particularly, and given the circumstances that are finding great stakes, not allowing the use of Lasix, we had at least 4 horses that bled in the Breeders' Cup, a couple suffering epistaxis incidents right out of the nostrils, the worst of which was Tyler's Tribe out of both nostrils. What are you hearing, and how are horsemen dealing with this? You know, horse players were at the mercy of this, have no clue who's going to bleed, who's not. In some cases, we're not hearing, you know, horses that underperformed, that bled, you know, leaving us completely in the dark. And I'm just curious, you know, how you know, anecdotally, what are you hearing and seeing and reacting to it?
Well, it is another extenuating circumstance that has to be considered based on, like, you know, what the horse's, continuing, ongoing careers, you know, how they will evolve. And, you know, you really, you know, like I said, I think the thing that probably put it really to the forefront was the number of turf runners from Europe that came and, by all accounts, except for the one sprint, they dominated the turf racing. Yep. And they run, obviously, without Lasix, as we do too. They seem to have adjusted much, much better. But besides the fact, I mean, that's just one factor, but they also have the best, you know, racing pedigrees. I mean, as far as for turf, our turf racing has been from the stallion ranks in this country for, you know, going on a long time now. So, you know, I mean, the best horses looking through a bridle, on the planet come out of Europe now. Europe and other markets, you know, around the world, some even from Australia. And that's just something that we, you know, have made a conscious decision to not replenish the ranks here. I mean, turf racing is certainly significant in this country, but as far as, like, if you go to the sales, I mean, turf, the turf sires don't, you know, you don't sell turf horses in this country. And I went to Ireland and been to Europe a number of times. I saw a yearling sold at Goff's at the first sale there that brought 6 million euros, and she's a foal to the multi-grade winner that she's a no-name never filly. It was a foal horse that was at one great ones in both Ireland and France. So, you know, I mean, you know, different markets for different things, but now, I don't want to get off the top of Lasix, obviously, but those countries have, you know, the European countries and other countries around the world, I mean, look, they'll train horses on Lasix to stop them from bleeding. They're not, you know,
yep,
the fact that horses do hemorrhage, but they seem to have figured out, like, you know, what to do. But I think a lot of it has a big factor here, Steve, is that our turf horses have to train on dirt on a daily basis. They can't go out and gallop on turf like they do in other places, or that basically would assimilate what a turf would be, you know, meaning, you know, the only thing I could think that would be similar to that would either be like the poly or the that's at Fair Hill.
Yep.
And they also have turf gallops that use regularly too. So there's advantage at a silly like that. But when you're on the racetrack, you've got horses that are stable at Churchill, Keeneland. You know, Keeneland, you could go to their facility, and then obviously Turf. But, you know, when you're at Churchill Downs, I mean, you have to gallop on there. And, you know, it's a different piece. You know, how you eat. A horse has to get fit, ready, trained, respond to being on dirt versus being on turf. And I do believe a little bit of the disadvantage compared to your contemporaries who come from Europe who train on, you know, a much more forgiving surface on a daily basis. So, you know, how to respond and what creates more and more problems, because bleeding is not just from the lungs. Bleeding can be, you know, a symptom that comes from soreness, or, you know, horses that are lame essentially can bleed because the breathing patterns change a great deal. And, you know, soreness can create a lot of stress on the airway, and it'll make a horse hemorrhage. I've seen it myself.
Sure.
And experienced it. A lot of horses that are very sound don't bleed. A lot of horses that are very sore do bleed. You know, that's one factor. So, you know, bleeding is not just a horse is complete. You can't just take his musculoskeletal, his respiratory, his neurological. I mean, everything has to be working in top, tip-top order for everything to go right. And the exchange of gases to bring in oxygen through the lungs into the heart, you know, dispersed by blood, you know, in the heart, to the limbs, to the muscles, this sort of thing. Everything is interlocked, you know, in a complete, you know, it's a complete package, and you got to look at the complete package. And, you know, that's really what, you know, that's what good veterinary professionals do. We've got a lot of them out there, so that's, we're lucky that way. And we'll figure it out. Hopefully with time, we'll bring some of the European pedigrees back here, and we'll get some more turf sires again once upon a time. Maybe not in my lifetime, but, you know, maybe sooner or later.
Wow. Steve, this was terrific. We've had so many wonderful conversations over almost 20 years. And Horse Health Today, brought to you by Luberson and Reborn and Dr. Allday and his team, Alex Hassinger, the Allday Way. If you got questions about your sport horse, your pleasure horse, and of course Luberson, basically created a whole family of products, human, also equine, obviously equine and canine, and just so many innovations, Reborn. Steve, great to get going again, and we'll get back in the swing with Horse Health Today. Best to everybody. Happy Thanksgiving, and we'll catch up real soon.
Best to you too, Steve. Take care. Thank you.
Dr. Stephen Allday, Horse Health Today, brought to you by Luberson and Reborn, and literally a game-changing veterinary mind, leading racetrack practitioner for decades. We're going to visit with Jessica Paquette, the new voice of Parks, and her career as a full-time track announcer started yesterday. It continues today. And oh my God, Jess, congratulations formally, and so great to, you know, to tune in yesterday and listen in. How you feel?
Oh, thank you. The support from the industry has been so wonderful, and it kind of inspires me to want to continue to get better and take the feedback and take the criticism and make everyone proud. It really means a lot that I have so many people rooting for me.
How much of a surprise was this to you, essentially, for an opportunity like this to manifest itself?
So after my last weekend of Court of Horses last summer at Sam Houston, I kind of put out into the universe that I would love to have my own meet by the time I was 40 as a, you know, big goal. And here it is. And I'm really excited to make the most of it. And the funny thing is, I never really thought this was possible when I was growing up because I hadn't seen anyone do it. So what I'm hoping is that this shows to kind of that generation coming after me that anything's possible. Your dreams are only as small as your imagination.
Well, how has your desire, I mean, kind of morphed? Because you got a couple of isolated opportunities early on, and and you know, clearly your interest and aptitude and desire, you know, to expand it grew from there, and the fact that you were open to becoming a race caller, that's, you know, that's part of the equation, really the core of the equation.
It's, for me, it's just kind of the next mountain to climb, and I think this is just so much fun. It's hard, you know, this is, you know, I'm very green, and I know I have a lot of room to improve, but I think kind of with the more reps, I'll be able to keep getting better, and I'm so competitive and my own worst critic, so I kind of want to push myself to be as best as I can be. It's just, you know, horses have taken me to wild, wild places, and the announcer's booth is one I never thought possible.
Amazing. And we've talked, you know, at different junctures, whether it was Suffolk related and Sam Houston related and Colonial, of course, these last few summers. Explain to everybody how you even came into the business and you know, your what drew you to racing to begin with.
So I grew up without a horsey family, and I was just a weird horse crazy kid. And we didn't grow up with a lot of money, and horses were a lifetime away, it seemed, kind of growing up in Lowell, Massachusetts. And I got involved with Kids to the Cup, and John DeSantis and Trudy McCaffrey brought a whole bunch of kids to the racetrack and showed us the world that was waiting for us there if we wanted to pursue a career there. So many of us fell in love with it and did, and it's a true testament to Kids to the Cup that, I mean, 20 years later, a lot of us are working in the industry in a lot of different ways. It was funny yesterday, Nikki Sherman, who was in Kids the Cup with me, came up to the announcer's booth to take some photos for me. She works for Equifoto and Phil Denver. And Susie Rasher, my childhood best friend and adult best friend, drove up from Long Island to come see me call my first races here. These, we were all in Kids the Cup together.
Wow, and we've celebrated so often with Johnny and with the amazing, legacy that Kids to the Cup you know, continues to have. We Elise Jacobs and Merv Huber and on and on.
And Emily Shields. And like, the Shields. List goes on. And yeah. The list just goes on and on. Sean Fells. Like, so many of us kind of are in so many different roles in the industry. And the thing that has meant the most is that as we've all kind of grown up into adults and found our own way, we've always had Johnny B in our corner. And that, knowing that there's someone kind of rooting for you along the way means a lot.
Wow. You know, I even pitched a read, you know, kind of a reboot of it at Symposium 5 or 6 years ago, one of those, that 45 ideas in 45 minutes. And, you know, each of us had to do 9 ideas. And that was, you know, I said, why are we not doing another version of Kids to the Cup? And, you know,
well, I'm always in if we can find
a way. There we go. That's it. What give out some of the bouquets to the people who have helped you along the way here and who you count on for advice and race call coaching.
You know, no one gets where they are on their own, right? And I'm lucky that I've had so many great announcers who have been friends or influential people in my life. P.D. Thornton officiated my wedding, and to me, you know, he'll always be my voice of Suffolk Downs, and him and Larry, getting to grow up working with them and learning from both of them. They both offered a ton of great advice as I've come towards this new adventure. Jason Beam is my biggest cheerleader and was the first one last night to have a report card of like really helpful things for me to do better, or and some positive things that I did well too, and that really helps. Chris Griffin has been so gracious as I've taken over his booth. We're dear friends, and yeah, he's really helped me find my way here. Frank Miramati encouraged me that I could do this. Kurt Becker has been so lovely, sending advice and encouragement. This is a great industry full of a lot of people who really root for each other, and it's been really evident to me this week.
What consciously, you know, what do you think? You know, how does your mind working, because this, of course, is different than, you know, the isolated race call. I mean, this is not just, you know, not just a full card of races day after day. This is a racetrack that runs year round. I mean, it is. Yeah, I mean, there isn't a natural break. I mean, there are some breaks, August notably, but it's a 12-month gig.
Which is the coolest part. You know, for me, since Suffolk closed, I just miss being at a racetrack all the time, and I can't get enough of it. And my time at Colonial and Sam Houston were always so wonderful, but then they ended, and I was sad. So now, every Monday for the foreseeable future, I know what I'm going to be doing. It'll be watching horses run in circles. That is fantastic.
Hmm. Well, the other question about this, and I wasn't even going to include it, but I think it has to be said. I mean, there has not been a full-time female voice in a booth in a long time. How much added pressure is involved in that?
Oh, there's a ton. You know, my ultimate goal is to leave this sport better than it was when I got into it. And I got where I am because so many women paved the way for women to have careers in broadcasting or careers in management at racetracks. So what I'm hoping is that I'm able to kick open a couple of doors for that next generation coming up from under me and make that path a little easier for them.
Wow, that's beautifully positioned. And we talk about being a good steward, and the definition of being a good steward of the game is to leave it better than you found it. And that really speaks highly of you. Jessica Paquette, best of luck going forward, of course, and excited for you. And we'll be watching and betting. And
thanks,
not at all. And I'm sure nobody is more proud than the Bad Horse.
He's waiting for me to get home with
Bob Stars. Jessica Paquette, everybody, who is so easy to root for and to be excited for as she steps into this full-time role. And everyone should be behind the effort. And it's a rather audacious decision from Parks, from Greenwood Racing, to give her this chance. And they should be appreciated for that as well. So, quite something. I think it's great. Seth Merrow is standing by, and he knows, even though he couldn't listen to the show on the stream, today. The stream will start as soon as Brian is able to get it over to Casey. Casey will set it up in the computer, so there'll be, if you go to the website and hit the listen live, the stream will pick up a little bit after noon at some point. So Seth, I think you probably can imagine that he's in for a ton of abuse. Let's get right at it, Seth. For the second year in a row, the Maroon come into Syracuse. Yeah. Go up the hill and fetch a pail of water, and they douse Jim Boeheim and the Saltine Warriors for a second year in a row. Not since 1962 has Colgate beaten Syracuse in back-to-back years. That was a four-year winning streak. We may be well on our way to that or more as the Raiders beat the Orange and beat them like a rented mule. Did you watch the game last night?
No, luckily I forgot about it. Very luckily I forgot about it. So that's what's happened since 1962. So, I mean, we're talking what Jim Boeheim's first year then. So it all comes full circle.
Hey now.
I read the recap later on, and I thought, oh, I forgot about the game, and I pulled up the recap, and I'm like, Syracuse shot about 30%, and I was playing back, I played myself this morning, and another guy said, did you watch the game last night? I said, no. He said, man, the defense on those three-pointers, he then mimicked one of the Colgate guys coming up, and he said, yeah, he comes to the three-point line, nobody comes to him, he just stands there, takes a deep breath, lines up the shot, boom, 3 points, no defense. So, yeah, I'm glad I didn't watch.
Well, the Colgate team record, 19 three-pointers, 19 for 38. You shoot 50% Yeah, to shoot 50% from 3-point range. They've been deadly from 3-point land the last several years. This Matt Langel has been just an absolute godsend, and Colgate locked him up. Boeheim, you might have enjoyed it. You said, you know, 1962 being Boeheim's first year. This very well may be his last year, because the let me tell you, the wagons are circling. The cat calls on Twitter for Boeheim's head are getting very pronounced. He looked like a deer in the headlights last night. Like his eyes were glazed over.
I will give him this much. I think a lot of years he does, when he gets new guys in the lineup, it takes a while. And sometimes in the first of the year, they really get into league play for the team to start playing well. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen this year, but I will give him that credit. And then he also said it's our zone is tough. And, you know, it's tough to play against these guys. And that, you know, a 50% three-point shooting team is the, you know, the nemesis of the zone defense. So they were up against it a little bit with the situation last night. But, you know, congratulations to Colgate. As I said, I'm glad I didn't watch.
I should have brought up, you know what, I missed the opportunity to when we wrap up. Maybe that's what we'll go. Maybe we'll leave with a Colgate, a great Colgate fight songs. Cheer, cheer, cheer for dear old Colgate. That's a good one. All right, I'll find it. That'll be.
You're living the dream this sports season, this fall sports season. Well, summer, end of summer, fall. Hey, Philly, Colgate, you're living the dream.
No complaints. I
started the season off all right, because normally Jets and Syracuse football, if, you know, the last, I don't know, however many years, that has been a little anemic. And this year starts great. It gets me into it. I'm back into football again, and then Syracuse will right off the cliff.
Well, and listen, it could be worse. We could all be in Louisville. where things are, I mean, they gotta be panicking. I mean, you lose what, 3 straight 1-point games, including the Bellarmine. Of course, for our man KK, for Kevin Kirstein, who's a Bellarmine grad, was happy for him. But last night, they thought they had a buzzer beater, but they didn't. They had to go back to the locker room. Well, I appreciate it, Seth. You're a good sport, and the Orange.
Well, as a longtime Jets fan, I'm used to it.
There you go. Well, the Jets are fun. Jets are exciting.
This year, as I say, I got into the football season again this year with the Jets and Syracuse. Syracuse went off the cliff, but the Jets held up okay.
Yeah, big time. Big time. Yeah. Well, I will bring you into and. What did you handicap for later?
I have Churchill and Finger Lakes.
Oh, very good. And they're actually a nice card of Finger Lakes today. Before we do that, I want to do the same thing with you that we did with Dick early in the show. And I talked about, we got a two-part conversation with you. You're eligible for, because Jonathan Kopierniak is from Portland. And he was asking, because he heard me talk with Dave Brennan, about the middle-priced long shot, the 5-to-1, the 8-to-1, 10-12-to-1, that's my sweet spot. Like, those are the kinds of horses that I'm looking for. I'm trying to find ones that that may be in position. Typically, you're looking for, and that's one thing we didn't talk with Dick about, finding this kind of horse. Ideally, in scenarios that offer extreme pace scenarios. And by that we mean super fast paces or super slow paces. Those are scenarios where you find a stalker closer in a fast pace that's 8-to-1 and has qualities that, you know, maybe it's a turn back to a sprint from a route, turf to dirt, whatever your whatever your particular angle is, dropper, whatever it is, finding that kind of a price in a race that then offers a pace edge, that, you know, really, for me, is the go zone. What Jonathan's asking, Seth, is how do you utilize that price? How do you leverage that? Do you leverage them on either end of pick threes? Do you key them in doubles? Are you keying them in tries and supers and exactas? Are you betting them heavy to win, like Dick Powell suggests? What's your approach? Because you are, like me, you are a guy that likes to bet a little to win a lot.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned this when you texted me earlier today, so I was kind of looking, and I have one in review and one in preview at Churchill, that are prices, and I'll give you one last Saturday, and I would say it's red boarding, except I was on TV, and if you pull up, if you go on the Capital OTV Twitter page, you can find the one sheet from Saturday where my top two picks in the sixth at Churchill reversed order. And so in the sixth at Churchill, going back to the Saturday the 12th, I had Bless the Kitten on top. High percentage trainer comes in up close up finish at Keeneland against a little bit better. So I put that one on top. And 7-2 on the morning line, and it held its, it was the favorite, but at 3-1. So it was a favorite that was offering some value. But then the horse I had right underneath in the second spot was Time for Trouble. It was 8-1 on the morning line and went off that at 8-1. Also coming in from a nice little second at Keeneland. And then I also had the 2 and the 5 in the mix. They were both at 9-2. So I had the 8-1 shot right underneath. And I guess everybody, how do you utilize a price? I guess everybody has to either go to their comfort zone, or I've always been an exacta guy, but I've been playing picks a lot now for the last few years. So if I get a horse like that, I'll look in the pick bets. I mean, if it's in a pick four sequence, let me see if there are some other prices in there. You know, if Flightline was in there, maybe I wouldn't be that excited. But if you can get a couple other prices in those subsequent races, I'll take a look at that. I'll also take a look at double. And let's say Flightline was the next race, then I'm probably not going to play the double. But again, as an exacta guy, if I can get that 8-1 or a couple of 9-2s in there, certainly if I can get a couple of 8-1s in the mix, I might go 4 deep on the exacta. And that's what I did last Saturday. I jumped in, and when I saw 8-1 and the favorite was a 3-1 price, you knew the money was going to be spread around in the exacta pool. So my top two flip-flop, and it was an $88 exacta, so that was nice. But as I say, I also took a look, because in the next race, I was also getting some prices, and it wound up to be the horse I had in the third spot, won pretty convincingly at 6-1, and that was a $60 double for a buck. I also played pick threes, because in the last sequence, my top pick was a big price. My top pick was Joyful Heart, went off at 9-1. I did not hit that. The horse who won the race, I didn't have in my mix. So I hit the exacta, I hit the double. And as they say, for me, it's just take a look and look up at the little pays and kind of, you know, use a little intuition on the picks. And if you have some other prices in there, I'll do that. But the first thing I will look is what's in the pick sequence and make that decision. And then I'm going to also take a look at the exacta prices. And, you know, I'm always four deep with the picks, and so is my top two flip-flop. And then my third and fourth choice ran third and fourth in there. And I kind of kicked myself back afterwards. I'm not that much of a tri player, but the tri came back for 50 cents, 121.
Wow.
So I probably should have played that a little bit too, because I'm not a big tri player, but in certain instances like this, I'll jump in. But I was happy with what I walked away with. And as I say, for me, it's you look up, and if in the top one or two picks you have that 8-1 shot, then you're just looking in that particular race. Does it make sense to look at the exacta? What are the prices of the other horses I like in here? And then also going forward, pick threes, pick fours, doubles. What are we, you know, the doubles, you can get a decent little, you know, probable pay there. And make your decision. So that's how I'll do it. Now, that's in review. In preview for today, the sixth at Churchill, It's a Maiden 150 claimer. And you talked about pace scenarios. For me, I tend to find prices in the baby races. I like the baby races. I like to look up the breeding and connections to get it done. And then that six to Churchill is an 850 claimer. I have it 175-2. And so I have two horses on the morning line who are offering a little bit of value at 8-1, the one and the five. And I have the one on top, Singing Emma by Sharp Azteca, who's very good so far this year. First time starters, 14 exacta finishes from 59 first time starters. A couple of win early siblings. One was called Infinity Squared that won the first two starts of the career. Another called Fairway and Green. Took five starts to win, but a couple of thirds and a second in there. Al Stahl's okay with firsters, so I'm going to put Singing Emma on top. And again, at 8-1, I'm going to be looking, you know, obviously, then making final decisions when I look up the board and see if that holds up. Second spot, I have Lady Baron. Tyler Gaffney-Ohm back on board for Brendan Walsh of a debut effort that was okay. There was only one racing sibling, though, Switzer, who took five starts to win. So I was a little concerned there, but with Jimmy Creed on top, worked 10.3 before the sale, almost lived up to that in the debut. Have to put that one in the mix. Valiant Praise, again, experience counts, so I'll use that one. But Grapes for Eloise, with the workouts underneath, at 8-1, I think this one could come out running too, so I'm going to use that also. And with a couple of 8-1s in the mix, again, if those morning line holds up, I will definitely do an exacta box. And I'm probably going to take a look at some picks as well, because I thought the eighth race was a little bit fun also with a couple of potential, you know, win early types. I have Flying Bessie on top in the eight. That one's only 7-2. The Moment to Shine, a first-time starter, I think is playable. That one's 9-2. I'd be nice if that one floated up. By the time I'm playing into the pick three, I won't know exactly, but... again, just in preview, given what we're looking at on the morning line in that six with a couple of potential 8-1 shots in there, I'll box up 1-7, 2-5, and then I will, in some fashion, use that one in some pick plays as well.
Well, we'll get into the sequence at Churchill in a minute, and when you give out some picks, I do want to focus on, you know, on Jonathan's question. You did mention Grapes for Eloise, and there is a point to be made about this filly. Now, this is one of these 150 maiden claimers, so essentially it's a maiden special way that they're running for 63,000, which is less than, you know, the regular 2-year-old maiden races are I think 120, right? Yeah, 120. This is a horse that came up with Amos. And with Joel Politi, this is one of his. And
oh, okay. I wondered about that. So this is Tommy's assistant, then, I'm assuming.
Correct. With okay. Amos, yeah. Amos is off for 7 days, and as it happens, Nehea is I'm not going to say sneaking under the radar, but we may be getting a little better price on this horse than you would have expected.
Oh, absolutely. And you look at the workouts, and I think the horse is going to be live. I'm not necessarily saying on the board. I'm saying on the track.
Well, live with our listeners who listen to Amos point out Grapes for Eloise. Yeah. Big time.
Yeah, I like it. Perfect.
All right.
But as they say, again, the theory here is we're looking for that, you know, the 5-8-1 shot, and you can make these kind of decisions, you know, when you handicap the night before or whatnot, but if that's what you're looking for and then you're going to play around, you kind of have to wait for the odds, particularly with first-time starters, for the board to open up to see if that those prices are going to hold.
I will also mention, since you did talk about the maiden races, that eighth race, 6 furlongs, these are 2-year-old fillies. This is a maiden special. And I think a lot of the action is going to involve Flying Bessie, and off of an okay debut. There's a lot to me. There's a live firster in here from Ricky Corville, Juju VIP, 12-1. This is a half to Dream Lil, who was a win early type and snake winner. I don't know if you're going to get anything close to the 12 to 1, but Dream Lift was a nice horse. 12 to 1, Davey Cohen, Ricky Corbin, Juju VIP.
Yeah, I didn't put that one in my mix. I did look at that one. I'm not going to argue against that, particularly if the price holds up. You know, this is the kind of race where you can play around. I'm with you. Flying Bessie was on top for me. I thought there was some wind early there. This was, as a sibling, folks may remember, the Ohio grad, Four Warren, that won in the second career start. It was a nice rated stakes place. The runner was out for Steve Asmus and Practical Joke on top. So Flying Bessie makes a lot of sense. And Moment to Shine was the firster I thought was intriguing. Paid a lot of money for this one. Worked 10.1 before the sale. Goes out for Larry Rivelli. Have him ready. By Pulpy Oro, that's notable. It's the dam's first goal. The race, though, that was the concern. But I think Moment to Shine could be interesting as well.
Well, of course, forewarned the wonderful Uriah St. Louis magic horse. one of the Uriah miracle stake winners that always seems to win at a big price. All right, we'll get back to those selections for Seth for a little Churchill and a little Finger Lakes in a second. What do we got? We got 6 minutes, 7 minutes. We've been answering this morning at the beginning of the show and the end here, Jonathan Kaperniak's question about how to utilize a price. But when I noticed he was from Portland, Seth, I said to him, you know, I'm going to ask Seth and Dick Powell, but Seth is from Falmouth. And I said, we're also going to have to give our favorite Portland area pushes. And Jonathan's got a couple of good ones that I'll offer up after you tell everybody the greatest places in and around Portland.
Food or any kind of place?
Well, food. I mean, I've got an ice cream push, of course, but mostly food.
The Lobster Shack, I like. Family always goes there when we're up in Maine, and it's just one of those, you know, oceanside, clam lobster joints, fried clams and lobster rolls and whatnot. Super popular. It's out by Two Lights, and Two Lights so named because there was the Modern Lighthouse, and then there's the lighthouse that replaced just up the street. But you're right on, you know, a rocky shore, and the waves are coming up and sitting on the picnic tables. Great location. But, you know, the food is that typical kind of Lobster Shack food, good fried clams and good lobster rolls and whatnot. Village Cafe, unfortunately, anybody up in the Portland area who's been for a while will know the name, was a really good Italian restaurant up there, which unfortunately disappeared a few years back. So I haven't been to the Village Cafe in a while because of that. But to Milo's downtown, it's on a permanently anchored ship right on the shore in downtown Portland. I like the Milo's quite a bit.
What's the place north of the house of our vacation house? Heading toward Freeport.
I never remember the name of that place. But you go right up Route 1 and you won't miss it. Muddy Runner. Is that what you're talking about?
Days Lobster.
Yeah,
there you go.
Yeah. I know Days. You're a Days guy. That's right. Yeah.
Days. Absolutely Days.
Yeah, Days is good, too, for all of that same kind of Lobster Shack kind of stuff, where if you want them to cook up some lobsters for you, they recommend it. Yeah.
Tina, who we have identified as literally Madison and Splash, she will eat right through the shell. Unbelievable. I will offer a couple of mine, and you know, sadly, Seth and his siblings sold the house out from under us, so we can't go up to Portland as often as we used to. It really was a home to us, and it was ripped asunder. Willard Scoops in North Portland is a fabulous little ice cream parlor. It's ridiculous that in a little neighborhood there could be an ice cream parlor like this. But the guy makes ice cream right on site, out of this world. Willard Scoops is my favorite, and I would drag Tina to North Portland virtually every night, and it started to drive me crazy. And I'll tell you one thing that is highly underrated and people wouldn't think about it. The pizza scene in Portland is fabulous. I will put Portland pizza joint starting with Otto, O-T-T-O, up against anybody. But Otto, you know, Otto's, there's several locations of Otto, but we've gone to the other top pizza joints in town. Very good pizza town. So between the lobster days and ice cream and pizza, there's my pushes. All right, Seth. And let me tell you about Jonathan's places. He says for drinks and raw oysters, Scales in Portland, and then a hidden gem outside of town in Yarmouth, the Royal River Grill. And yes, that is the Royal River that is referenced in Shawshank.
I'm not sure many people are those, but I'll have to put them on the agenda.
Why? Are we buying a new house?
Well, I was up this summer in a VRBO with my sisters and their families.
And you didn't invite us. All right.
Unfortunately, we didn't have room. It was.
Well, then.
I was on a couch in the basement.
All right, you got 2 minutes to give everybody your pick three, your pick four, your whatever, your 8-1 shots. Let's find some.
I'll do the late pick four at Churchill. First lake there, the seventh 50,000 allowance runners. And I haven't pulled up the scratches yet. I'm 5-1-3-2, but I'll use the 5-1. Pledge of Allegiance goes up first up, the claim for owner trainer Steve Asmussen, off a nice win last time at the 50 conditional level. So this is a class move, but this horse has been bouncing around and competitive at this level in the past few races prior to the latest. So that one on top. And then C's gets degrees, comes in good form. Nice win last time on the front end from Keeneland. So I'll use both of those, the 5-1. In the 8, Maiden Special is going 6. I have an 8, 2, 9, and 4. Talked about this a little bit earlier, the 2 Flying Bessie, you know, practical joke, 27 exacta finishes for 96 first-time starters this year. And as I mentioned, sibling 4 Warrant, another sibling called Fortune's Fool, who won in the 3rd career start. So I liked Flying Bessie. Moment to Shine with the 10.1 were both URO, who 19 exacta finishes and 64 first-time starters this year. Pam's first ball, however, but I'll use that one. Dazzling Blue, I really like the intermissions first time out. The dam produced a sibling called Sharecropper that was 8th in debut and won the 2nd start. So I will take up, and if the 12-1 holds up and I get through my first leg, I will put some win money on Juju VIP, just so I'm not kicking myself after that one. But I'll use the 8, 2, and the 9 in race 8. The next two legs, I'll go 40. I have in the 9, 2, 1, 7, and 5. I'll use all of those. Cassidy Goat hasn't been seen since May, but the first two starts, the first start of the career was promising. And then Trite Allowance Company off of the debut victory and faltered a little bit. That was at a mile and a 16th. Comes back at a mile. That's a little tough, but sometimes these horses that are lightly raced come back even improved. That November 4th workout maybe indicates that. So Customer Driven underneath, another one that hasn't been seen since May, but I think could be live given what the workouts look like on the return. Potenza broke the maiden for a tag and then stepped up into Allowance Company and wasn't quite as good. So I'm a little bit concerned, but I couldn't leave it out given the debut effort. And then Romance Novel for Dallas Stewart, who's off to a nice start. I think this one could be a player as well at a price. So again, 2, 1, 7, and 5. I'll use all of those. And then the finale is another fun 2-year-old race. 2, 9, 3, and 6. Again, I'll use all of those. Ransour, Midnight Storm doesn't knock it out of the park with first-time starters. And again, when I talk about first-time starters and horses have had a couple of starts, I'm just looking at those first-time stats as, you know, indicating win early. And so again, Midnight Storm doesn't knock it out of the park, but okay. There's a sibling called Trident Hit that won its debut. Another sibling called Ready My Way that won in the 2nd career start. Another sibling, Just an Old Song, won in debut. There's enough there that I'll at 10-1, I'll put the number 2 top. Rec Walker Point comes in and I think can be live for Wayne Lucas. Motown Collection.
Motown Collection for me at 10 to 1. Big time.
Yeah, I'm coming in from Thistle Down. I think we'll get a little bit over.
Got to wrap it.
Okay, so 2, 9, 3, and 6 in that finale.
Very good. All right, Seth, I hope everybody got them written down. Thanks for a great segment. Talk to you next week ahead of Thanksgiving.
Sounds good.
Well, don't hang up because we're going to go out on the break and head out to the day. And here we go. There we go. Fight, fight, fight for dear old Colgate. There it is. Talk to you tomorrow, everybody. Thanks.
With Steve Bear on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at PennVet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare program set up by our horse schools. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and raise.
Who are you betting on? How about an athlete? Stuttering hooves, fist pumping, hoops to your ankle, robust weekly promotion. Offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action. With NairaBet. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBet.com for details.
The Box Family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and curly stands in Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappet, Osler by Warfront, as well as Freezing Fire. Maryland's 5/8-mile training track completes the full-service facilities from the bowling barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm. Our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? The University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians, thoroughbred racing, standard bred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Leader Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880. Horsemills.com is the most effective time to see payments from your vendors or generate electronic invoices. Check out our video tutorial on the horsebiz.com.